Welcome to our Friday Five Live podcast hosted by Meg Foster. Meg has spent 20 years in higher education focused on student success initiatives and working in areas such as orientation, faculty development, online learning, student leadership, and first-year initiatives.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome to our last Friday Five Live podcast of the 2025 school year. It is hard to believe that we are here, counting down the days until we start 2026. And, you know, we've been doing this podcast now. This is our fifth year. We started in April of 2020. So right, you know, within a month of shutdown. And it is kind of remarkable to think I really thought that in 2021, you know, we were going to be like, this has been the craziest year in higher education. But Lanita, I think 2025 is going to take the cake
I think
for
so too.
the craziest year yet in higher education. So we are joined today looking at this year of 2025 in our crazy world of higher ed, and then thinking a little bit about what might conjecturing. I always kind of call this our crystal ball episode. What might 2026 bring us? Really thrilled to get to have Dr. Lanita Cordova with us today. She is the Assistant Superintendent and Vice President of Student Services at San Joaquin Delta College. Lanita has the most fascinating background, and someday I think we just should do a webinar on that, Lanita.
Thank you.
Like, spent time serving in the U.S. Navy, has a teaching certificate, worked with educational counseling with special needs students, if my understanding is correct, has a PhD in psychology, and has worked in a variety of different capacities in our world of higher education. As I mentioned, currently serving at San Joaquin Delta College, but also providing instruction as a faculty member at, is it Cal State or UC? I'm sorry that I'm not
Stanislaus in Turlock, California. Yep.
Yeah. So just you're really touching higher ed in a lot of different capacities. And I think you bring such value to it with that K-12 experience too, that you have kind of rolled up. Cause I think that, you know, just really gives you that kind of full picture of this world of education that we're all working in. So just as a quick housekeeping reminder, folks, we love the chat in our Friday Five Live podcast, and just love seeing so many of you here with us today. You've done a wonderful job of introducing yourselves. Please feel free, continue to introduce yourself. As you know, if you've been with us before, I've prepared kind of a list of questions for Dr. Cordova, but we welcome your questions as well. So don't hesitate. If there's something you want to conjecture, if you've got a question, something you want to pose, or something you want to celebrate. You know, I think it's a great time to do that reflection. I know we often do this as we look at a new year and setting goals and things like that. But I feel like this year has been a particularly tough one. And so if you have something you want to celebrate in your world of higher ed that you have accomplished, you've had a student be particularly successful, throw it in the chat and let's all celebrate that today, because I think we need that as well. All right. So Dr. Cordova was kind enough to come on and be brave enough for me to be like, hey, you want to come talk to me about our crazy world of higher education? And so would love to know, like, so as you look back on this year in particular, anything that you feel like was, oh, and this feels particularly appropriate for California, excuse the reference here, but a seismic shift, right? Like any kind of change that you're like, wow, this one is going to have a big impact on us for years to come.
I would say the biggest one is financial aid. We really did our best to prepare for the quote unquote simplification of FAFSA. And just with the recent changes that took place, I think that was the biggest shift for us. Based on the demographic. So I'm in Stockton, California. We have a large, I think we're about 49% Hispanic, 30 to 35% Asian Pacific Island, Southeast Asian, Hawaiian. We have about 7 to 10% African American, and then the rest are Caucasian white. And then we have multiracial identities here. So we're very diverse. And I think that between the financial aid And then the changes in immigration with ICE, we really, those were some of the biggest challenges that we had with our undocumented students and our AB 540 students, which are our dreamers. And these are students that are going to school or have gone to school and are undocumented. So I think just students and the fear, you know, whether it, I don't want to politicize anything. But, you know, if you're student-centered, you're student-centered regardless, right? And just to have students coming or sharing that they're afraid to come to school, that I think was really tough. That and then just figuring out how are we going to fund our students. There's programs that have been decertified. So, you know, education is what counseling, therapy, social work, you know. So just navigating that, I think, just trying to stay grounded in your why and supporting students and just trying to really keep everyone focused on students and their success rates and our responsibility in higher education to provide students with what they need to change their lives. I think that to me was one of some of the biggest challenges.
I mean, and you know, with that piece about the funding piece, I mean, has such ripple effects. Whether that's, and I haven't even been able to read this morning's news about, you know, loan situation and SAVE and the end of that in higher ed. The simplified financial aid form. So, some good news today was that the financial aid application numbers are much higher than they have been. So it's great more students are submitting that. I do think that's a positive sign, but you're right. We're seeing, you know, the end of HSI designation and the implications of that as far as funding sources. You know, I know working with many institutions where they've seen a loss of Title III funding, they've seen a loss of TRIO funding, you know, programs which impact, you know, quite frankly, our students who have the greatest need, right? So, and then and that's not even touching on our R1 institutions, which are struggling with reduction of funding for research and the implications for graduate students. So, I do. It's going to be interesting to see what that means long term.
Well, and to your point, like think about our low-income students who rely on student loans to become doctors, lawyers, you know, professions that you have to have a lot of education for a reason. Nobody wants, you know, a doctor who got a C, right, all the way through school. So I, you know, and the cost of medical school. So how are those students who don't have families who can fund their education going to access those professions? And, you know, those are the questions that I ask. I think about our students who dream about specific, you know, ways of helping their community. Here in the Central Valley, we have a healthcare desert. We are hurting for healthcare providers. So that's going to impact our students because the access to, you know, being healthy, to show up to school, to show up to work. So I think those, you know, that's another one when you talk about education, and that impacts our CSUs, our UCs, our private universities, because with the caps on the student loans now, how are we going to pivot to make sure that students are reaching those, you know, highly or costly educational programs, right? Because of the cap that's going to be there. So it'll be interesting to see how we're going to navigate all of this.
It is. It is. And I think you bring up, and you know, and we never want to be, I always try to strike a balance here. I don't want to be super negative, but I also don't want to be falsely positive. But, you know, I think you used a really important word, and that word is fear. And I think that there's been just a year of fear, quite frankly, from students who are uncomfortable coming to campus. That concern, I mean, I work with at a community college that serves a great number of students who are here in various capacities, some documented, some undocumented. I had a student who had to leave the country. You know, how can we continue learning when we're being forced to leave? And so that there's a ripple effect there. Or if you're feeling that constant fear in your community. And I feel like there's been some themes this year, some threads this year that have really tied to that 2020 year. As far as that, the weight of that, maybe.
Well, I don't, honestly, how have we recovered from 2020?
Yes.
I would say the hits just keep coming.
Right.
We finally, I wish we were talking this morning about return to campus, and we did a good job in 2020, I'd say three, of getting everyone back on campus, faculty, classified professionals, and administrators. But there was still a lot of anxiety from COVID. There was a lot of fear, a lot of unknowns. We were working really hard to get our students back on campus, to build trust, to build those relationships, to show the community that we were still here, we're still open, we still want to serve you. And I don't know if we ever recovered from that fear. And then it just, when you think of from a mental health perspective, your body doesn't differentiate. It just knows I'm uncomfortable, right? It doesn't know that this is COVID fear versus this is, a different type
Not
of
in that
fear.
bucket. Right,
Right.
right, right.
Exactly.
You can
Exactly.
shut
So,
that one down now, right?
yeah. Yeah.
But I also think that, I mean, we learned a lot that year of, health, and I don't know that that fear is really ever going to go away.
Yeah.
Like,
Yeah.
yeah.
I wish we could instill more hope. Like that's what I try to focus on is the gratitude parts of it, the hope. I'm a firm believer that sometimes we're uncomfortable because change is meant to happen. And so when we're too comfortable, we ignore the signs that it's time to shift or pivot or, shift our energy into something that's going to be, you look back, hindsight is 2020, and we say, oh, that's why that happened. So I'm still waiting for that. I'm hopeful that that will come.
Well, and maybe that's a good thing to focus on. You know, something that's was there anything that surprised you this year? Maybe in a good way. Anything that when you think about that hope, an infusion of hope, how do we do that as professionals, right, in higher education? How do we kind of hold that space for ourselves, our coworkers, our students?
Yeah, I think it's, the hope that I've seen is with the engagement that we're starting to see on campus. We do something called Welcome Wednesdays or Wellness Wednesdays, and we're starting to have 300 students participating in our Wellness Wednesdays. So there's an uptick. We have double the clubs than we had last year. I think we're starting to see a shift of those students that have been back in the classroom for a while now, and they're more comfortable engaging in that face-to-face, in a face-to-face modality. So that's something that I'll say a trend that I'm seeing that is instilling hope is that human connection, because that's the key part of what we do and why we do it, is that humanity piece, the humanistic piece, in being just a small blip in transforming someone's life. So I think that's the hope that I would focus on, is we're starting to see the pendulum shifting to more on-campus engagement.
And I think as I think about one of my roles, and if you all are not signed up for this, put your email in the chat and we'll sign you up. But every Monday we put out a newsletter that's kind of what's happening in higher ed in the last week, and it's my great privilege to get to work on that. So when I think back on some of the big data trends I've seen for this year, that has been a big data trend, is that students really want, they're craving relationship. They talk about the importance of friendships on campus. You know, I think we've long talked about belonging in higher education, but I think this year has really been one where all the survey data of students kind of speaks to their return, their need, great desire for that. So so I love that you brought that up, and I saw that in my class. It was really great. I asked my students to write their final exam as a letter to me about what they've learned in my first year experience class and how they're going to apply it to semester two. And several students wrote about friendships that came out of that class. And I thought, well, that's if that's all we do, then we've done. That's really important, because I
That's
always talk about,
powerful.
yeah, who's going to be your person? Everybody needs a person on campus. Doesn't matter if your person is your advisor or teacher or student, who's your person? So seeing that kind of return to relationship on campus is really something to be hopeful about, Lenita. I
Yeah,
love that.
agreed. Agreed.
Yeah. Anything you're doing or seeing about helping our faculty and staff kind of reconnect with that sense of hope or help.
We've brought back some of our cultural, like there were things that the campus would do, pancake breakfasts, holiday parties, ugly sweater, like I shared, we have our ugly sweater party today.
Love that.
Just trying to build opportunities to nurture community because, as you saw in the chat, someone said that they're still completely online, and that is a big change. I think, as somebody who is an educator, I was a teacher for 4 years. I was a counselor for foster youth services and alternative education for 8. Collaboration is key. I think, for me, the benefits of having a multiple subject teaching credential was that I learned how to collaborate with other teachers, to improve my instructional strategies. And I know there's webinars and online ability opportunities to do that, but the most powerful times for me as an educator was going and sitting in another counselor's office to watch how they ran their counseling appointment and getting little tips and tricks from them to improve myself. Same thing as a teacher, I would go out and observe other teachers or put myself, provide opportunities. So I'm not saying that that's not happening in the online environment, but to what extent are those types of relationships and partnerships being nurtured? I think that would be something I would wonder about, and how, and I think seeing our faculty engaging in some of our community-based, things that we're trying to build a campus culture, seen, heard, and connected. I think that that's for our employees as well as our students. And so that sense of belonging is important, I think, for employees as well. So that's something that I would highlight that I think we're doing that I'm proud of, but I think that that's a way that we're is supporting our employees as well.
I do think there's been some really phenomenal work done in the last. So as I think about something else I'm hopeful about, and you were touching on this, that idea of culture. Like I feel like institutions are really taking some very important space to examine the culture that they've built. And is that culture one that is addressing student success? Is it student-centered, but not student-centered in a way that negates faculty and staff? There's a balance there, right? But how are we building these campus cultures where all of us can thrive in this learning environment? And that is exciting to see, because I think when that is done well, and I know you have done so much work with us at Delta College, you're really breaking down all those silos.
Trying
And
to.
yeah, and I think that gives me a lot of hope, because honestly, I think if higher ed is going to thrive and continue to make the case for the work we do and why it is important and impactful, I think that collaboration piece that you spoke to is
Is key.
just, yeah.
Well, and I'll share with you, we were an Anapezi school for Asian American, Southeast Asian students. And when we lost our HSI MSI status, we lost our Anapezi funding. So that's going to be going away in 2026. And when you talk about partnership and coalition building and that unity piece, what we're working on is some bipartisan language to talk about the why of this funding from a very moderate perspective, because it is about, creating opportunities for students to succeed, because there's that model minority myth that all Asian students are going to go into being medical doctors and engineers, when we know here in our community, we have a very large Hmong, Lao, Cambodian, Southeast Asian population, and they are not thriving. So, I think that type of coalition building is something that I'm really excited. We have faculty, we have classified professionals, we have students working together to create a document, for our board of trustees to be out talking about and for educating our community as to this isn't a political issue. This is a, how do we support our community type? There is a return on your investment, right? That we're not just utilizing these funds for fun and feelings. It is about student success and helping folks to earn a living wage and transform their lives and be quote unquote functioning members of society. So that's another collaboration that I'm proud that we're doing, is really looking at ways to influence legislation, because I think that's where it's going to be key. We can sit in our campuses and, like you said, focus on the negative and feel frustrated, or we can empower ourselves because we do have a voice in academia, and that takes us coming together because we're stronger together. And that's something that I've seen start to happen, is that real coalition building that I think is a positive, that shows our students how to mobilize in a way to advocate. They have rights, and we don't have to just sit back and have things happen to us. We can be proactive in a bipartisan way because I think that's what it's going to take. It's going to take everybody coming together, our legislators, our policymakers, our educators, our community members, in voicing their concerns, so that we can be heard.
Yeah. I mean, I think that as we think about trends for this year, mean, just to be completely frank, it is if you are doing DEI work, which every one of us is doing DEI work, that has been a very hard thing this year, and a thing that has not provided a lot of hope, and the careful nuance of the language that we're having to use. When as you're speaking, all the word that keeps coming to my mind is equity, which is now like such a loaded word. And so I really appreciate that you brought up how are we thinking, and this takes such mental energy, and I want to acknowledge that because I think we're already being asked to do so much, right? But how do we think creatively beyond the confines of our institution? And I know we're this work is being done, but even more creatively to reach out in our communities to tell our stories. Because when we do that, I mean, we've all seen this happen, right? Then all of a sudden you have advocates where you didn't have advocates before.
Absolutely.
And then those folks, let's be frank, they vote, or they're another voice to your legislature. So whether that's state or national, helping to tell that story about what is happening at Delta College that is transformative for your community. And KR has brought up, I work at an HBCU and we've had to reword a ton of language due to bans on words. And I just I've I'm just got to say, I know that that is mentally exhausting.
Well,
And
and what does it say about, a lot of us go into this work with our why? I'm biracial. I'm half black, half white. And for me, it's, I know how education transformed my life. So then it feels like a personal attack on your own identity and who you are, to say that, we hear about the DEI hires and, that it alludes to, if you were thinking of a subtitle, the subtitle is people of color aren't smart enough to be in these jobs, so we have to hire them based on, DEIA language. And, I think that's the part to me that can be dehumanizing. And that's where, to what KR is saying in the chat, that I think it's important for us to, that's where you have to focus on what do I have agency over and how do we get more strategic? Because we are smart, we are academics. If we could utilize that energy to come together to say, okay, we've been doing universal design strategies. That is DEIA work, but it doesn't say diversity, right? It's not one of those buzzwords right now. So how do we pr adopt universal design strategies that focus on one small community? Boom, same thing, and then, I think for me, it's I love Star Wars and I believe in, like, how do I protect myself from that negative energy so that I'm not exhausted? Because that's what it's about, is we have to, I think that this administration is intentionally exhausting us. I think it's intentionally wanting us to be in a state of fear and chaos because then we're not paying attention. And so if we can protect ourselves through therapy or self-care or vacation or family time or whatever that is, so that while we're in our work, we're being strategic, in maybe figuring out ways to protect our feelings from this and say, okay, what are the facts? What do I have control over? And someone said block. And then, oh, what was it? We were at a conference. I was at NCORE last year and they just said block. We've got to block what's happening. And then we have to rebuild. And we have to rebuild in a way that's good for students and our community. And we have to come together and stay diligent. And I think that those are some tools. And that's why I love innovative educators. I feel like what we're doing is having conversations around giving people more tools in their tool belt to validate our feelings of exhaustion, but then to say, okay, it's not our fault, but it's our responsibility. So,
And KR shared that they had an in-service of 3-page list of words we can't use. And I mean, we've all sat through various in-services where you thought, oh, if I could only have that time back, right? Imagine what I could have done. And so I'm just so sorry to hear that because I can't imagine how painful it must be.
Yeah, exhausting. I hear
Cool.
you. I hear you. I think we've all had philosophical questions about, for me, I went into this work thinking I'm going to change the world. I know how education has positively impacted my life. And there were times where I just had values-based conversations with myself about, you feel like the curtain has come down. And there was this belief that education is this transformative life changer. And then when you start to see the political aspects of it, it can be demoralizing. And it is exhausting. And so that's where I think the self-care parts of this are important. And being a radical diplomat, I found that that's what's helpful for me, versus I'm not that person that can go in angry and fight against everything. That's not my nature. I'm not a revolutionary that way. I have to have peace and balance because I think that's important. So, KR, I just want to encourage you to take care of yourself, and do things that feed your spirit and protect your peace where you can.
Do want to let everybody know, as we mentioned, we're going to send everyone the recording from today, and this does become a podcast, which can be found on every podcasting channel. Last month, we had Shannon Cooper, who's also, we're just really pulling on our California peeps, Lenita. Shannon came and talked with us about really this concept of caregiver fatigue in higher ed for our faculty and our staff, and things that we can do, systems we can put into place to help us. And it was a really great conversation, and Shannon is an amazing professional, so I would really encourage anybody. I think that pairs well with a good cup of tea or a nice walk. Put it on, listen to it. Just people left feeling really lifted. And Shannon has some really very simple, practical things we can do in our work world to provide that kind of space for renewal, for hope, for rest. So I do want to put that out there as another resource, because you're right, we do spend a lot of, we think that's really important in this space to give folks the chance to kind of come and say, here, let me share this with you. You're not alone. And we want to give you some resources to support you. I do want to ask this question. Are there things that you think we haven't talked about enough this year? Like that, and it's been hard because, as you've said, it's been a year of so much. And I know, just being in the space of having to react to the many things, whether that's language or funding concerns or the safety of our students, or just goes on and on and on and on. I know that's been just really exhausting, but anything that you feel like we just haven't really maybe touched a base on enough. I know I have one in my mind, but curious what you'll think of too.
Things we haven't touched based on. Well, I think for me, it's the unknowns. I think there's just so much that we don't know. Like day to day, we were in reactive mode for at least the first 6 months of the year. And then it's about like processing, taking a deep breath and saying, okay, what if this is actual law? Because I think that's what we decided to start doing was bringing our coalition together to say, okay, what if this is law? What is just a recommendation? Because some of those white papers were, although they were called executive orders, they weren't legal yet. So, we had to slow down and take some deep breaths on that. So I don't know. I feel like we're still processing, at least for me, I am. I would love to hear your thoughts.
I think one thing I've not, and maybe it's because of where I am and where so much of this, our students are adult learners largely, right? Like in the US, we're really, 18 to 24-year-olds are not the majority of our college students. And I worry that I'm not hearing enough about the impact of this year on our students who are also parents, because I think that just really is a population that can be particularly vulnerable. I think about, cuts to SNAP funding, to having to reapply for SNAP funding, and I the C campus, folks losing childcare resources, but I also know how transformative that is, right? If we can take a parent and get them a credential, and then the ripple effect. That's one of the things I always teach my students. I'm like, your education impacts future children, right? Like,
100%.
it's going to impact the educational level of the kids you someday have, or the kids you have now. And yeah, that ripple effect. And I don't know that I'm hearing enough about that population right now.
So
But
we focus a lot on adult education, and I can share that where we're partnering is through, we are now have conversations going on at Delta College with Adult Education Human Services Agency with our CalWORKs program, so welfare to work. And there's about 6,000 students that are potential students for Delta College that are eligible for CalWORKs, but are also a part of our adult ed population. And for those of you who may not be familiar about adult ed, these are adults that do not have a high school diploma, GED, or California high school proficiency. And we have legislation called Ability to Benefit that they can attend community college and take 11 units a semester with financial aid. So that's kind of ways that we're addressing, because CalWORK serves single parents. It is for folks who, it's male or females who are parenting, and that want to find a trade and want earn a living wage. It's that support to do that. So that's ways that we're addressing those populations. Something that we also were able to provide is a homeless housing insecurity program where we're partnering with a local transitional housing program to do rapid rehousing and bridged housing for our students. And the beauty of that partnership is we do the academic piece, and then Lutheran Social Services, who's our transitional housing partner, does all the wraparound support services. If the person struggles with addiction, housing, things like that, they do all of that for them, and the coaching, fiscal, financial awareness. So, there are some ways. I think what I would say, if you're in a state that doesn't have those programs, how can you partner with some of your local community agencies that do that? Because I guarantee you, if you Google transitional housing programs, there are some social services out there that you might be able to partner with. And I think the beauty of that collaboration is that there are ways they can spend their funding that we can't. And there's ways that we can spend our funding that they can't. And then that really creates that, I would say, a way to provide resources during tough budget times, or to support populations that maybe your budget has been cut for because of DEIA language. We were partnering with a local organization to educate Black women about breastfeeding and nursing, and just low-income folks as well. It's called REACH. They lost their funding. All of them were laid off, and now they're not going to be able to provide that support because of the language that addressed serving specific populations. So we're exploring ways to continue to partner, at least through contracted work, because we know the importance of lactation services and things like that for some of our communities. So I think I would say definitely community partnerships would be ones that I would investigate or explore for our single parent populations.
When you bring, as we think about kind of shifting to looking at like next year, I think one of the housing, the cost of living, I mean, everything is just, it's so expensive. It's expensive to operate our institutions, but it's so expensive for our students to put food on their tables and, commute. And if they are doing that or have, stable, safe housing. So I think, your message about how, again, how are we thinking creatively within the communities that we serve, whether we're a 2-year or 4-year institution, it doesn't matter, those goals are the same. And that was something that Shannon really encouraged last month in our podcast. And it's funny because I told her she sounded like my 85-year-old father who spent his entire career as a community college provost administrator. And my dad has always said, we can do a lot of things, but we can't be social services. Like, we can't do that.
Yes, I agree. I agree.
And Shannon said that exact same thing. And she said, but that's okay because there are these amazing services in our communities. And we should all be able to say, here, here's these resources that we've connected with and that we have these meaningful relationships with. So,
And to your point, Meg, like, this is where you can get creative. But you can also build partnerships that you're not duplicating services. Because I would say that there's a lot of reciprocity within some of the work that we do as community partners. And so to really have that understanding and education around what, who does what, what are their grant objectives, that's a powerful conversation because now you're maximizing your own funds. You're not having to spend a set amount of money to do something if another agency can do it and you can partner to do that work. And now you can, reallocate that funding for maybe food or, other direct services for students. I'll say that we have food banks in the local community, and with the holiday season, a lot of them have been selling out, or not selling out, but the food is gone within the first hour. And so we've tried to be strategic with our food pantry, so that we, gave students food right before the Thanksgiving break or the 4-day weekend, if you had a 4-day weekend, because we recognized that some of the food banks were going to be empty. So we told the food banks, if they're a Delta College student, send them our way. So we tried to partner on certain things like that. I think that's the benefit of those types of conversations. And it could be as easy as an advisory group where you go through, we have something called Community Connections 211 that you can go on, and it lists all of them in one place. I don't know if other people have access to resources, a resource page. Your human services agency might have it, and start calling and emailing folks and saying, hey, we're looking to start an advisory group to support our students, especially with the SNAP benefits going away, and take that proactive approach to community coalition building and support services.
I mean, you think about the people who work at our schools. I mean, we're, they are connected to communities, or they've worked in those agencies, and they have real insight into how that works. So, really leaning into those experts that we have. We only have this always goes by real fast. So I want to make sure we get anything you're looking closely at for this coming school year or coming year, next semester, and anything you're kind of hopeful for. I mean, I love that you brought up that relationship piece. Other things that you're thinking about for 2026.
I think it's just going to be continue to maximize those community partnerships. That's how we're going to sustain ourselves as budgets are cut, as funding is cut. Just continuing to look at ways to explore how we can continue our services. And maybe it doesn't have to be done by us, but partnering with others. Something else that I know our president is looking at is doing some surveys and research on our programs to make sure we're aligning with labor market needs. Oftentimes students want to go into culinary arts or fashion, which is great, but are you able to earn a living wage? And for some of our students, it's about, let me get into some type of career technical program where I can make $30 an hour and then go to school to find something else, right? Like, how do I sustain myself while I find myself? It sounds silly, but I think that's important too. And I think that's something we're going to focus on next year, is really assessing our programs and are we aligning with what the community needs. We have 72 career technical education programs. So, for many of our students, it's educating the community about those, exploring ways to rapid reskill people, upskill people so that they can, make it through these next few years.
And as we get ready to have a year that's going to include workforce Pell, I mean, there's going to be some,
Opportunity.
new opportunity there, which is really exciting. I'm doing some work now with dual enrollment students who are career technical, and it's exciting to see, how that can progress, right? And the impacts that that's going to potentially have on their immediate future as they step out into the work world and enroll in our community college.
But it's almost like we're going back to the 90s, because when I was in high school, we had ROP programs. We took banking classes, we did woodworking, we learned home economics. Like, there was embedded kind of CTE programs within the high school that I wish, I mean, I think that's not a bad thing to go back to, is having our high school students learn a trade, right? They do it in Europe. At 16, you learn how to do plumbing and electrical. And if that's your, you find your passion there, then you do an apprenticeship program. So I think there's a lot of opportunity there for sure, to your point.
I do. It'll be interesting to see kind of as this year unfolds, because I think you're right. I mean, even at our own home, we've talked about, I mean, we've got a kid in college and we're like, oh, it's I don't know if it's enough to get a bachelor's degree. Like, I kind of feel like you also need a workforce credential alongside that. So let's do it. Let's do the EMT certification. Let's do, thus and such. And that way you've got some options there. Karen is reminding us that there's DECA still exists. It's still there in the schools. And I think that is an interesting, Lenny, and I'm glad you brought that up because I think that'll be interesting to see. And we're seeing, a lot more interest in the trades, that big theme of what is the return, what's my ROI, right? For this expensive college degree.
Well, and think about pre-COVID, we did not acknowledge our essential workers the same way that we do now. I think
Oh,
that you're
yeah.
starting to really see a shift in the appreciation for the trades, because those were our essential workers. They were on the front line. So, I think it's a positive thing. And as institutions of higher education, curricularly, we know it takes time to change curriculum. So if we can start to be proactive now, that's another thing that I think as we look forward within the next year to start thinking about, like, how do you create short-term certificate programs for your students that allow you to get the completion, that align with the CTE workforce requirements of the federal government, and you're being fluid, right, in preparing students as well.
And that, I mean, another theme for 2025 that we really didn't touch on, but I think ties in is, I mean, AI is changing the nature of work, right? And so in many ways, I mean, I've had so many conversations with folks about what are going to be the areas that we can go into that are sort of protected, that AI is not going to take your job, right? Is that education? Is it something in the medical profession? I mean, I know my kids are talking about that, like, oh, maybe I don't want to go over here because AI is taking on computer science roles or what have you. So, another interesting theme. Lenita, it's going to be really interesting to see what 2026 brings us.
100%.
Yeah,
I
but
can't believe we're going into 2026, if I'm
I
being
know.
honest. When I think back 30 years, it's 1970 in my head.
I'm right there with you. Very confused about this coming year, which will be in got to call out. I mean, I'm in Virginia. We're very focused on this is the 250th anniversary, right? July 4th, 1776, and we are all about celebrating that moment. It's just an interesting inflection point, I think, for our coming year. So, well, thank you so much for
Thank
joining
you.
me to talk about this crazy year that has been 2025 and what 2026 might bring us. Just a general reminder for everybody listening in, we believe very firmly that you need time for rest and renewal. And so whatever that looks like for you, I hope there is time over our winter break for you to take a walk, breathe deeply, do those things that really help fill you positively as we move in to 2026. I do want to give a shout out if you enjoy our podcasting format. January 23rd will be our podcast for the month of January, and we are talking about executive functioning, which I am really excited to dive into. I think it's a great topic to kick off a new year with some real practical strategies for how we can do this work with our students. So I love that Tamara has shared, she's still 25 in mind, as am I. That was a great year. So I think that personally, I felt I have not really left that year. So I love it. Well, we hope everybody has a fantastic winter holiday. Look forward to seeing you back in 2026. I will say, let me quickly put into our chat our survey. If you can fill that out for us, it helps make sure that we're providing you the content here in this space, if I can find it, that you need. And if there are topics that you're like, I would really love for us to talk about, we're already looking at like design thinking as a topic for 2026, executive functioning. I'm sure we'll talk some legal issues in higher education because those are always going on. But let us know with that survey where we can help you. And Lenina, thanks so much. I hope you have a wonderful winter holiday season, that there's time for rest and renewal in your schedule, as well as a tacky sweater party or two. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Friday Five Live is brought to you by Innovative Educators. Innovative Educators offers 6 online services for your onboarding support and training needs. Visit us at innovativeeducators.org to see how we can support your student success initiatives.